Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guesthouse overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundation@hearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission.
Hey, good afternoon. Keith Clark, Company Distilling, and we are in beautiful Thompson Station, Tennessee, about 30 miles due south of Nashville.
Uptown Thompson Station?
We're downtown Thompson Station. Mm-hmm. We're one of five buildings, so even if you don't know where we are, if you can find your way to downtown Thompson Station and you're a bit of a gambler, you got a 20% chance of knocking on the right door.
Very cool. What brought you here? Why did you set up a distillery here?
You know, that's a great question. Long and fun story. I'll keep it quick, though. So home for me is near Lynchburg. So I grew up south of here, you know, Lynchburg, Tennessee, home of, there's a small distillery down there you might have heard of.
Jack
Daniels. Yeah.
George
Dickel. Yeah. Those are my stomping grounds. It's kind of crazy, you know, where, you know, the buckle of the Bible Belt, but my childhood was, I grew up around whiskey. My parents didn't drink, and my grandmother was a good Baptist that would fight you if you accused her of it. But man, she always had a cold. And so there was Jack Daniels and honey in the refrigerator until the day she died.
And yet your county was a dry county, right?
Dry county, yeah. Moore County was, and still
to this,
is a dry county.
Day.
Yeah, and so that's kind of a weird artifact of Prohibition. So when Tennessee came out of it, there was a legislative scheme that required voter referendum on access to alcohol, whether you want liquor by the drink or a package store. Those are separate referenda. You know, that's two different questions. And then there's also a manufacturer referendum. So Moore County voted to allow manufacturer, but they still haven't voted to allow access to the distilled
retail
product.
Sales.
That's right, retail sales.
So Jack Daniels did an end run workaround, right?
A little bit, yeah. Had a little help. Jack Daniels operated down there dry for many years. And then in the 80s, there was a commemorative bottle loophole that let them sell special bottles. And then, you know, when I was involved with the Tennessee Distillers Guild, we did a bunch of legislative efforts and some reforms. And so part of, you know, manufacturing now allows a retail license. So it's technically still a dry county, except at Jack Daniels, where you can buy bottles down there that, you know, that are Jack Daniels produced. But that was home. And so my path here was, both my mom's brothers are engineers at Jack. You know, Uncle Bill's been their lead engineer for 40 years. You know, he's retiring at the end of this month after a 40-something year career at Jack Daniels in their engineering department. And so, you know, growing up around it, I apparently talked about it a lot. So my formal training is as an attorney. My boss several years ago got sick of me talking about whiskey. Told me to shut up or, you know, do something about it. And so that kind of led me to this legislative effort some years ago, because, you know, put up and shut up was kind of, okay, how do we do this, you know? But the surprising thing about distilling is that if you want to make distilled spirits, the first thing you do is not go buy a still. The first thing you do is you go get permission, and you really need permission from, you know, God and everybody to get started. And so this was 2008, so it's been a minute. But distilling was then illegal in 92 of our 95 counties.
Wow.
So you think about the state where more whiskey is made than any other place on the planet.
Was it power and control?
It was just inertia. So the barrier to entry was brutal. So it wasn't just you got to vote on it. But for the manufacturer question, it was really goofy. So you had to get signatures, go to the county commission, and you had to have a special election. And so in special elections, and, you know, Matt can tell you this from his days in politics, special elections are nothing but how do we cram something through that only a few people want. Nobody votes in special elections except people that care.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had to have a special election on this distillery question, and it had to win by 50% plus one of the votes from the last gubernatorial election. So you take a high water election and make it a special election. And it's just like, you know, who's...
Good luck.
Yeah, good luck. So that was part of it. The fix turned out to be simple but hard because of vested powers and politics and more wrangling between partisan politics than anything substantive with the legislation. So
where would the blowback come from?
Well, so my dentist introduced me to another patient of his who was a state senator. So he was a Republican state senator. This is 2008. At the time, when I met Senator Ketchran, the Tennessee House was still Democratic and had been Democratic control since Prohibition or since Reconstruction. So you're going back to the 1800s. Been a while. While we're talking, there's an election, and the last seat called in that election was a seat in Rutherford County, and that seat was very close, and it flipped control of the state house from Republican control to Democratic control for the first time in about 100 years.
From
Democratic control to Republican control.
Republican,
yes. Yeah. So it was the beginning of, some years of Republican control, but even in 2008 through 2012 or so, mm-hmm. it was pretty tight, especially in the House. You know, it was within a few votes. The blowback had nothing really to do with the legislation. It had everything to do with, like, if we can take out that House sponsor, maybe we can get the House back from Democratic control.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So it had nothing to do with substance.
Nothing to do with substance. Everything to do with pure partisan politics.
But yet you made it work.
We made it work. I met a few folks in that journey. A guy named Mike Williams, who was a former Democratic state rep from this district. This was his district. He retired. He saw which way the winds were blowing. Also, had started lobbying for one of the interest groups in the state. And so he was a known commodity as a legislator. And so I met Mike through this process. And so he showed me kind of how to lobby. And so we knocked on a lot of doors. And Mike knew how to get it away from the potholes. Mm-hmm. And so, a lot of that was timing. The idea was simply, let's get rid of this referendum requirement under the premise that people who are okay with drinking weren't going to mind if somebody made whiskey. That core idea sort of kept the choice scheme in place. But more than that, Mike was, dexterously able to move the ball mm-hmm. in ways that didn't offend people. And because he had friends on the Democratic side of the aisle, we got enough people not to vote against it. They didn't vote for it. Mm-hmm. They just didn't vote. So we were able to obscure enough abstentions to get it through. That's really how it worked out.
That's interesting. But the legislation, if it had not passed, would that have been a deal breaker for what we're doing now?
Absolutely, 100%. Okay. Yeah. So I don't know what would have happened subsequent to that. There's been reforms in a lot of other states. But Tennessee now has 40 distilleries from Bristol to Memphis and everywhere in between. So at the time we had three, and they were all down there in Lynchburg, Tullahoma. Yeah.
Wow. That's crazy.
It's nuts, isn't it? There was distilling going on. It was just, wasn't taxed. Mm-hmm. So it's been, it would look different. I don't know. Who knows what the future would have been? Well, I wasn't the only person wanting to get in the game. Mm-hmm. So people have been nibbling around the edges. I think our approach of big tent is really what helped make it work.
So Uncle Nearest, mm-hmm. for example.
Yes.
That recently opened would not have happened?
Wouldn't have happened. No, not in Shelbyville. So Bedford County, though it's adjacent to Moore County, which mm-hmm. is home of Jack Daniels, Bedford County was was dry, or didn't allow the manufacturer, rather. So they had package stores and restaurant, liquor by the drink, but never had dealt with this manufacturer question.
And this is off topic, doesn't have anything directly to do with you, but it's a great story. The story of Uncle Nearest.
Isn't that good?
Yeah.
It's a great story, yeah.
Can you give us the Cliff Notes version?
I sure can. It's a great story. Nearest Green was a freed, enslaved African who made whiskey down in Lynchburg. And that's not unique to Lynchburg or even Jack Daniels. So the story of whiskey, especially in the South, can't really be told without talking about the role that African slaves played in that. It was hot, hard work, and the folks doing all the work, not just the hot and hard work, were enslaved in the South and even up in the North while most of the whiskey was being made. And so even if you look at some of the roles around, it is grotesque as it is kind of think about, but today there was a premium paid for individuals who knew how to distill. So enslaved Africans who had distillation skills cost more. Isn't that crazy? I mean, it's but that was a reality at the time. And so Nearest Green was, you know, one of many African Americans who were caught in that situation, and he was good at it. The Call Farm, which is adjacent to where Jack Daniel's is now, was where he lived and worked. And so it's good to be able to tell that story now.
But didn't he teach Jack Daniel's how to distill?
He was probably doing the distillation, you know, on the farm. And mm-hmm. so, and, you know, absolutely would have been the person with the skill sort of sharing that knowledge. You know, I think the Jack Daniel himself, you know, he didn't start that distillation. It was, you know, the Calls were involved in that. You know, his uncle, who was a Methodist preacher, actually owned the distillery. And when, you know, distillation registration was required, you know, he thought it might look bad for a preacher to have a distillery. So he deeded it over to his nephew. But yeah, Nearest Green was the guy doing the distillation. And so it's a fascinating story. So there was a book published by Jack Daniel's back in the 50s that really told, you know, that was telling the history of the distillery, including that of Nearest Green. And so it's been available for sale for years and sat there, and, you know, people would read the history but not really move on it. And so I think the ability for entrepreneurs like, you know, Fawn Weaver, who's, you know, just an incredible force, you know, she sees that story. You know, you don't have to go to Lynchburg to make the whiskey if you don't want to. There's more room to do it. Mm-hmm. She's got a latitude to start her brand in a business-friendly environment here in Tennessee.
And it's working.
As far as I know, I saw on Fred Minnick's newsletter this week that Uncle Nearest had just crossed $100 million in sales. So that's a significant amount of sales. It's an expensive business to get into. So they're certainly selling a lot of whiskey, and I wish them the best. I think it's a great story to tell.
And why do you do what you do?
It's a good question. My wife asks me that all the time. It's like, what are you running from? I'm like, I don't know. If I stop, I'm afraid I'll die. On the whiskey side, I love the smell of the whiskey, you know, from a kid, like the mash, the barns, and, you know, my dad spent his career down the road from George Dickel, and so I just always fascinating. And really, it's a bit of the contrarian in me. So we are Southern Baptists, and don't drink. And so I know in California that may sound crazy, but there's still a very healthy, sizable contingent of our neighbors who still follow that rule, at least in public. To me, the fascination wasn't just the craft. You know, you've got this all-natural craft, the wood, the fire, the mystique around it. But everybody was proud of Jack Daniel in Tullahoma. It's a lot of civic pride. Or this is the place where everybody around the world knows where we're at. Mm-hmm. You can go to any spot on the planet except maybe Utah. And I've had that experience. Say, where are you from? Say, Lynchburg. And they're like, Jack Daniel's. And honest to God, I've gotten to travel a lot in my life. I've been blessed to do that. The only place where it was like, well, so what, was Salt Lake City. Some of my LDS business partners in another line of work. But so civic pride is so important. And so that juxtaposition between this stuff's bad, but oh, by the way, let's take all of our friends to the distillery when they come to town. Right. That's what happens. And so that tension was fascinating. So as I've thought about it more and gotten older, I really think that tension in the community was what drew it. Having access to it, you know, getting to go with Uncle Bill to stomp around there, having it see it up close, that also helped. You know, so I got to see stuff that most 12-year-olds wouldn't. You know, I've shoveled bins of grain from the bowels of Jack Daniel's when we were down there picking up ribs or something and a pot blows out carrying corn, and so they're like, here's a dustpan and a bucket, see what, you know, get at it. You know, so it's a rich part of my childhood, both family and then curiosity wise and then it's turned into an important piece career wise and so
are you still lawyering, or are you just
still doing a lot of that? Yeah,
but whiskey is your day job, right?
Yeah, gin is my day job. Okay. So yeah, we have used to be whiskey gin and gin, and so we are exclusively gin these days. And
interesting. Why did you do that? Differentiate?
So I might have drank too much whiskey once in college. And so there was a period of time where I wouldn't consume whiskey at all due to this overindulgence. In that same window, I had the opportunity to go to the UK and study. So I got to spend a semester over in the UK in college. And not to be deterred, I enjoyed Scotch whiskey and gin. And so my wife and I really enjoy, you know, martinis and gin cocktails. And frankly, I think gin cocktails are more interesting. You do more stuff with them. You've got a little more reach. And so when we started planning out our recipes here, you know, 8 or 9 years ago, it was, you know, the bourbon recipes, I kind of knew what I was going to do and how I wanted to push them. And the gin was, I didn't know. I knew I didn't like X, Y, or Z gin. And I knew that I didn't like, you know, these weren't good or this one was pretty good. And so we didn't set out with anything other than the idea of, like, we're going to figure this out and build a gin that we like.
What are the deal-breaking, deal-making variables in the
gin?
Yes.
There's so many.
Oh, really? I thought there'd be two.
Gin is harder to make than whiskey.
Yeah?
You can make it faster. You can have the turnover a little quicker. But in terms of day-to-day, there are far more variables. So,
and part of this because you can't mask your mistakes?
Yes. Yeah. That's a big part of it. It's either right or wrong. There's no barrel to fix it. There's no time to... And it's constantly moving. Corn is basically the same anytime you use it. If it's dry, decent corn, you know, food grade corn, it's always going to taste like corn. Same with barley. You know, you can get a little variability if you malt it or roast it. You know, you can push it that way, but it's predictable. With gin botanical, everyone that's in your gin is a variable that bounces. Now, we found that juniper's kind of the same. Some are a little more astringent than others, and so we pick and choose where we get our juniper based on probable softness or astringency. Coriander, we use that. It is the same everywhere. It doesn't move a lot. But citrus is really a wild variable. You can get an enormous amount of bounce in citrus. And so...
An example of injecting that citrus character, what do you put in?
So we use lemon peel and orange
peel. Okay, both.
And we found that certain orange peel could be really bitter. Lemon peel is fairly stable, but it can get kind of bitter and funky if you're not careful with it. Orange peel is really the wild card.
This is stuff that you actually grate in, or how do you inject it?
We've done both. Yeah. You know, at scale, you're going to spend a lot of time grating oranges if you're going to try to do that. So practically speaking, you're going to get dry orange peel. And so where do you get it? How do you get it? And so we had found a source out of California, one of the citrus farms there, that was just a fantastic, sweet, top grade, you know, zest. It was dried. And then the wildfires a few years ago just skunked the orchards and put them out of business.
Wow.
And so it's been a couple of years of unsatisfactory orange. You know, we're constantly trying to find that magic. And so we have to make adjustments down the recipe. So if we got to put more orange, what does it do? There's going to be more oil, so we got to account for that. So that variable of the weird orange peel has really thrown a lot of difficulty into our production.
Well, you know the story of Curacao, right?
Curacao, yeah, no.
The Dutch in the colonial days brought these oranges down to Curacao, but they sucked. They were just really weird, but they wound up using that to make the Curacao the liqueur.
Yeah.
And
oh, that's good stuff.
And they're still going.
Oh, and you know, the Grand Marnier, the orange, of course, can be so good, but it's, you've got to be picky with the orange peel. Have to know if you're looking for what sweet note and where. And they move on the still, too. And so the aromas come off at certain points, flavors come off at different points. They mix up and do different things.
So your end result might be very different.
So whiskey's a little, so if the heart run of whiskey distillation is pretty constant. So, you know, when you get your barrel grade whiskey, it's not going to taste a whole lot different than the last drop you take off. And so it's pretty steady, pretty constant. Gin is constantly changing. So if you taste the gin, you know, we're in eyeshot of the still now. And so just looking at the hydrometer from here, I can tell we're getting close to the end of this thing. You were probably at probably 80 proof coming off the still, so 40% alcohol. So we're into our tails pretty deep. That stuff's going to taste pretty weird. The stuff that's coming off when it's 160 proof, is going to be hot, but the first stuff is going to taste, in 30 minutes if you check it, it's going to taste different. 30 minutes later, it's going to taste different. And so, you know, how do you pull those components together is a constantly moving.
What you're alluding to are variables that are to some degree impossible to
find. You can't account for all of them in a rational process. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we just over time have built up the knowledge reservoir of I kind of know what should be happening at this point. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, every batch is different. So I could taste that gin and know pretty, you know, as soon as I taste it, where we're at in the run, are we ahead? Are the flavors ahead of the take cutoff point? Mm-hmm. So that happens too. So a mistake a lot of distillers make will, you know, they'll try to rationalize a process, which is understandable. Like, okay, we're going to stop taking off our distillate at X proof. That's probably right some of the time, mm-hmm. but unless you can control all the variables to that, it's not going to be exactly right. You know, Jack Daniel's, it's exactly right because they can control all that stuff.
But it follows there's some learning curve.
There is, yeah.
That you can apply into future batches.
And it's one of those things that's kind of hard to teach, but you develop the library of touch points that you kind of know it intuitively when it's there or not.
Okay, going forward, is this, we're at the ground floor of the new Renaissance?
I think so. So you saw this movement in craft beer really started popping in the late 70s. There were, you know, I don't remember that. I was around during it, but I don't remember much of it. In the 80s, I remember Sam Adams being out there and just kind of like pockets. But and then my recollection, that's pretty spotty. I had an uncle that drank Bud Light, and that was it. And so Bud Light was really all we saw. You could get Michelob at the Pizza Hut. And so it was really the only interactions I had with beer until I was in, I'm not sure if my kids are going to listen to this, so I'm going to say college, was really like Bud Light, Michelob Light. But then Jack Daniel's started a brewery. So Uncle Bill was one of the, you know, engineered this brewery at Jack Daniel's years ago, and they had a amber lager that was really good. And so that was right about the time Sam Adams was taking off. So right about the time I was turning 21 was when the craft bubbly era had really popped into the mainstream. Mm-hmm. And so you started seeing you know, more craft beers around, and so now it's ubiquitous. Like, it's almost as everything's gotten so normalized, like you can go to some strip mall and it's going to have the same stores here as it will in LA, and there's so much of that, you know, sameness everywhere. But beverage alcohol, whether it's wine or beer, or, you know, in Tennessee now whiskeys and whatever, we're, you know, gins, that's where community and difference get expressed. Like, that's some variability that's really localized. And so
I noticed with brewers and whatnot that's what they love. That's the challenge.
Go find something weird and different.
Yeah, and then do it again.
Yeah, well, see, that's the addictive part of entrepreneurship. So I'm a bit of a, I guess, adrenaline junkie. So I've started, you know, 4 businesses in the last few years. And the most exciting time is right at the beginning when it's a creative process and you're going. And so developing the recipes and figuring out how to make, you know, our whiskeys and our gin, man, that is the most exciting time. You know, the problem is if you're constantly creating new products, you never really get around to scaling and developing, you know, a sustainable market for your other ones. And so, you know, as a business matures, you kind of pick, you know, scale or development for your avenue. And so you still see a lot of new guys coming to the scene in Tennessee, and there's a lot of really interesting distilleries. And what's really cool about the timing when you're here is that, so I started my first distillery in 2014, so about 8 years ago. Mature Whiskey, a lot of other distilleries got started that time too. Old Dominic, Leaper's Fork, Pennington. Then a few years later, you've got Postmodern Distillery in Knoxville doing some really cool gins and some malt whiskeys. Most of the guys who started in 2014, 2016, we've got Mature Whiskey now. And so the first 5 or 6 years of a craft distilling movement may not be particularly interesting. Products aren't really ready for prime time. But we're in a window now where there are several distillers across the state who have really dynamite distillate of their own. You've got folks doing some really cool blendings, bringing together some whiskeys in different ways. And so what you're seeing now is, how do we create new and interesting whiskeys with existing inventory and stock and stuff you've got. So the blending game is coming back. It used to be a bad word, but just the absolute, I mean, some of the best whiskeys out there are blended whiskeys. You know, the company bourbon, I think, is dynamite. I love, like, the Four Roses Small Batch Select. I mean, oh my gosh, that's a delicious whiskey. The blending is back, and I think some of the best art in the whiskey space right now is people bringing together components to make something really cool.
Well, historically in Scotland, going way back, 95% of whiskey is blended.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
It's crazy. Yeah. And it, you know, you think the single malt or the single mm-hmm. barrel, you know, that phenomenon sort of made that a bad word. But let's take Scotland. You know, that's a small country with huge diversity of environments, you know. And so you bring some of this, you know, Islay whiskey and blend it with some Highland malt, and you can get some dynamite stuff. Yeah. You bring that character from all over.
Yeah.
And so we're finally getting over the single barrel phenomenon a little bit. Like, you know, it's still fun. It's still interesting to see what that unique barrel does. And some of them are dynamite. Mm-hmm. Every now and then, one's just off the chain great. They're all different.
It's pretty random, isn't it?
Yeah. But if you want to...
How your kids grow up.
Yeah, right. That's right.
Yeah.
So I'm happy to see that come in, so some really superior products can come out with.
So future looks pretty incredible to you.
I hope so, yeah. You know, the
Why
sun...
Yeah.
You know, there's cloudy days, but the sun comes out, so it's, you know, come through COVID and supply chain stuff. It's been a hard time to... Mm-hmm. To start a business in any space.
Even the workforce thing, that's crazy.
The workforce has been tough for a lot of people. We've been so lucky here. You know, the team that helped us get through COVID, Northrop, Thomas Graham, you know, Tim Brockdorf, Kim Peterson, those folks couldn't run them off. I mean, they stuck with us through thick and thin.
Their family, like it or not, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And they're, you know, just, it. You know, when people don't take paychecks but keep working, you know, those are high character people.
The one thing you haven't mentioned is yeast.
Yeast, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, part of that's, it's a hole in my knowledge base, to be honest with you. I experimented a bunch with, you know, trying to make whiskeys out of beer yeast. I've used champagne yeast. I've used Cabernet yeast. And I will tell you, one of the worst things I ever tasted was a bourbon mash that I fermented with a champagne yeast. And I was trying to get high gravity, because I'd try like high gravity beer yeast, and it was so terrible. The whiskey was awful. The beer wasn't good. And awful, not because I'd made like a sanitation error. That's a different problem. Right. You know, this was a clean ferment, but it was just terrible.
Isn't that interesting?
And so I champagne yeast, like, this will be fun.
Mm-hmm.
No, it tasted like corn champagne. So it was truly atrocious. It was not good. I'd even distill it. I was like, I'm not even distilling
maybe
this.
Maybe the Iowans would like it.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe in Ohio they might get down that too.
Yeah.
I don't know. So in experiment with yeast, you know, there you can buy sort of stock whiskey yeast. There's a little variability in those. Their yields tend to be like 6 to 8 or 9%, and the flavor profiles can be really different, all within the whiskey family. So you kind of have to, you know, and then on the higher grav, there's some yeast out there that will produce high alcohol, but they're high in ester production too. And so those get kind of funky. And so for us, it was, how do we find a balance between, so that whiskey character. So we would try pure whiskey yeast on the pot still. And we'd get great taste in whiskey, but it'd be so heavy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this thing would, you know, heavy flavor, and there would just be oil, you know, chunks of oil coming out of there, because it'd just be thick. And so we're like, well, a little too much. So how do we sort of cut our yeast with a high grav distiller's yeast, like a vodka yeast. So how do we get some whiskey influence with some higher, you know, so we blended dry yeast to get there. Here, we've got a guy on our team with a company named Kevin Smith, who is like he's a yeast nerd. And so he literally, you know, wrote the book on yeast for the Distillers Council up in Louisville. So I'll leave that to him now. So,
well, I was in Southern Indiana interviewing a very successful distiller. He has no fear in taking risks or whatever. He thought Fleischmann's.
Yeah, bread yeast, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, he said, why not? And he used it, and he loved it.
He liked it. Yeah. Bread yeast would probably be better than a beer yeast. I think, you know, a lot of the beer yeasts are really selected for certain flavor notes in beer that may not work in whiskey. But Fleischmann's, I think, as I understand it, was a very well-used yeast during Prohibition. A lot of people not making bread.
I love it.
My name's Cody McElroy. I'm the head distiller at Company Distilling in Thompson Station. So I'm in charge of all the gin right now. We do have a master distiller named Heath Clark. He's kind of my boss, so he's the mastermind behind all the gin and the recipe and this beautiful Portuguese brandy still we have behind us. Yeah, so day to day, I run the still just about every day. It takes about 9 hours or so. So it's a perfect shift. Come in at a, you know, at a crisp 9 a.m. It's nice. And then I'm usually out by 7 o'clock.
And how did this start for you? That wasn't your major.
So I got a degree in digital media. 18-year-old me wanted to be a professional Facebooker and do, you know, social media analytics and web design. But, you know, 21-year-old me, whenever I graduated, I just hated computers at that point. But both of my parents have a law enforcement background. And I grew up for part of my childhood in Florida surfing. So I decided, you know, this is like peak pandemic when I graduated and government's always hiring. So I applied for the Coast Guard and tried to use my degree to get into officer candidate school. Long story short, I had too many wrestling injuries from high school. I wrestled all 4 years. And my medical record makes me look like a Frankenstein, but best shape of my life right now. And I was going through MEPS, which is like the whole medical processing.
We're getting in the military.
Yeah. Right, yeah. If you've ever seen like Full Metal Jacket or Platoon or whatever, anything that has that boot camp, it's like that 4 hours of getting poked and prodded and blood drawn and stuff. But
I just had to redo that about 9 months ago.
Yeah. Yeah, I had to go back in. I mean, it was great. It was like a free doctor visit, but they couldn't take me. I remember I was sitting there, and, you know, it was like 3 hours into this. There's fluorescent light and basically like in my boxers in this cold concrete room, and they had moonshiners on the TV. Oh. So I was sitting there fantasizing about it. Yeah, so as soon as it fell through, I came in. I live right down the road. Had a suit and tie, super overdressed. I'm in overalls now, but said I wanted to make liquor. So here we are.
That's so cool. Yeah. It isn't just making liquor. There are certain things that resonate with you. Talk to us about that.
Especially with such a small batch operation like it is now, there's a lot of art that goes into it. I mean, every day, like the still never runs the exact same every day, right? So you have to count for things, you have to be there to adjust, and like by the time the still is done, I mean, it really is your baby, right?
So it's almost animate.
Definitely, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if your still doesn't have a name, it's bad luck. So.
Talk to us about what can go wrong in the distillation process.
So I'd say that safety is always the first priority here. I mean, there's always going to be somebody back here watching it. The biggest thing with ours is it's an open flame still. So we're burning natural gas with a metal pot full of very flammable liquid. You always have to be, you know, conscious of what's going on with all of your senses. Smell is a big one, especially vapor in the air that you can't see. You can usually smell it if it's alcohol or, you know, propane or any sort of natural gas.
Is that a reason we have the door open?
I usually just like it just for ventilation. It's not that we have a leak and it has to be so ventilated. It doesn't hurt. The air conditioning doesn't work in here anyway.
How about in the middle of the summer?
It can become a sweat box. The biggest thing is that this is a 100-year-old granary, so there's not a whole lot of insulation. We really tried to keep as much of the structural integrity of the original building as possible. The only thing that's really changed is the attic upstairs is the biggest one. Since we keep barrels upstairs, it has to be very well reinforced. They're super heavy.
You're focusing on gin right now, correct?
Correct.
Talk to us about some of the variables, the challenges, and the rewards of doing gin.
Okay. Well, the big one is a happy smile from the customer when they taste it and they're like, this is good, you know? Mm-hmm. And I wasn't here whenever they won the double platinum Ascot Award. Definitely still have some pride in that name. So biggest challenge, I mean, with distilling anything, especially like bourbon, if you don't know if it's good or consistent for 4 years. So I'd say the biggest challenge is definitely maintaining a consistent, precise measurement of everything. You know, it's like, got to be like Walter White. You know, you have to measure everything perfectly to the milliliter.
Interesting. And gin, unlike an aged bourbon whiskey, your gin comes out, it's ready to go, right?
Yeah. Yeah. As far as new distilleries go, you have to have a product that you can put out on the shelf almost immediately after opening, right?
So you can pay your bills.
Yeah, exactly. And you can maintain a constant flow of all the spirits, right? Because back when they were doing the whiskey here as well, I mean, it was each day was a different thing. So you have to keep a constant rotation. So there's a lot of balance.
That's really interesting. We talked about barrel-aged whiskeys. In some cases, I don't know if you guys can do that, but 12 years, 14 years?
Yeah.
Yeah? Possible?
Yeah, so we've only been distilling here at this location since 2014. I haven't seen the barrel, but there's a rumor floating around that there's that first barrel is still, it's still over at the Rick House, sitting and waiting.
Patience and time, and we talked about this recently.
Totally.
In another distillery, and it has to do with you don't get any return on investment for 12 years or 14 years. Yeah. You almost need stockholders in the barrel.
Yeah, right. It's like, you know, the lumber as well, even for like oak barrels. I mean, if you were going to try to get into the barrel business outside of, you know, not wanting to wait for alcohol to sit, I mean, that's 20, 30 years for a fat oak tree, you know?
And the cost of oak barrels has gone up dramatically too, right?
Yeah, and it's not even just the cost, but the supply for a lot of things. I mean, yeah, barrels and glass are the hottest commodities right now.
That's really interesting. Talk to us a little bit more about gin and some of the flavor profiles that you like.
Sure, yeah. So we use 6 ingredients. It's very basic, but very true. The biggest notes that we try to hit is in our citrus department. So a lot of people like the juniper, the pine taste, but a lot of people, it's like 50-50, you know, like you had gin in college and you won't have it again, like tequila. You either love it or you hate it. But we're trying to make our gin more palatable for everybody. And a big thing that people seem to like is citrus. So we really push the orange and lemon peel very heavy. And also the cardamom seems to give it kind of that citrusy, almost a spicy kick.
Interesting. And out there beyond your world, what makes a gin great and legendary? It seems like either it's pure and is what it is, or it's not, you know?
I think it's the love that goes into it. I mean, you can go to, you know, Bombay or whatever and get this gin that's going to be consistent every time. You know what you're getting. The thing about such a small operation is that every ounce of that alcohol is being watched and monitored and really pushed to the limit of what it can be quality-wise.
For example, your finished product is very distinctive from, say, Tanqueray or Bombay, right?
Yeah. A big thing for us, too, as well, with bigger distilling operations, they have these massive, you know, massive stills, these huge fermentation tanks, and you can only pull a specific flavor from a specific style of still. So if we took our recipe and put it in a different still, I mean, even at a different altitude, it can affect the flavor. So I think a big point for us is, you know, this Portuguese hand-tapped copper still that we have. I mean, it's only 100 gallons, but I mean, she does her part, that's for sure.
So you're real blessed in a lot of ways, aren't you?
Yeah.
Be invited in and get to play in the
right, in
the laboratory.
Yeah, our doors are always open. We love it when people come in and we're like, here, try this and try this, you know, and if I'm trying to experiment with something and, you know, try to get my, you know, my thing going, I'm like, try this, give this a go and try to mess with things.
And your label and your retail distribution is where? How would somebody find you and your product?
So if you were looking to purchase online, you can go to companydistilling.com on our website. And then through there, we have to use distributors with the law in order to sell the alcohol. On our website, on companydistilling.com, we have a link to a couple of different distributors where you can get it shipped to you.
And locally, Franklin, Leaper's Fork, in Nashville, you could find it in bars and whatnot.
So a lot of Central Tennessee, you can find it. We have one store in Georgia that our distributor reaches out to. But, you know, hopefully, I mean, start with the East Coast and hopefully make our way over to California if we can.
I love it. So that means that when I come back, I get to say I knew him when.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you want me to sign a bottle for
exactly, you. Exactly, yeah. With a thumbprint.
My name's Cody McElroy. I'm the head distiller here, and our location is Thompson Station, Tennessee.
Thank you so much, man.
Thank you.
All right. To learn more about your world, where would you direct us?
Oh, go to companydistilling.com and check us out, and then There's all the social media stuff if you're into that. But yeah, there's great content. And then we also have been lucky to have good folks like Visit Franklin and Blunt Partnership telling our story too. So you can find information about us that we didn't produce lots of places.
Love it.
And my name is Heath Clark, and I am the Gin Guy.
And I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Tennessee.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guesthouse overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students, preserving the past and inspiring future generations of dreamers. These children experience a world of science, technology, engineering, art, and math at Hearst Castle, STEAM, along with studying the legacy of Julia Morgan, one of the most important women in the history of engineering and architecture. The foundation at Hearst Castle not only changes the lives of children, but also provides lifetime memories and unrivaled experiences for our generous donors and members. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundation@hearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission. You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guesthouse overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students, preserving the past and inspiring future generations of dreamers. These children experience a world of science, technology, engineering, art, and math at Hearst Castle, STEAM, along with studying the legacy of Julia Morgan, one of the most important women in the history of engineering and architecture. The foundation at Hearst Castle not only changes the lives of children, but also provides lifetime memories and unrivaled experiences for our generous donors and members. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundation@hearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission. You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory, produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer on KCBX Radio. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York, and in fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.